Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're ready to hear argument in the case of Talley against the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Stern.
Chief Judge, and may it please the court, the issue for the court in bank today is whether when Congress enacted the Consumer Credit Reform Act of 1996, it made the United States subject to damages liability. And the district court and the plaintiff on appeal, making arguments that are, we would suggest, aren't perfectly sane arguments. They're looking to the original language of the 1970 Fair Credit Reporting Act, as enacted by Congress, which has a definition of person that includes any governmental entity.
Mr. Stern, do you concede that if this case had been brought in the Federal Court of Claims, the plaintiff could rely on the Tucker Act, big or little, for a waiver?
No, Your Honor. We don't think you could bring this case under the Tucker Act, under the Little Tucker Act in district court, or under the Little Tucker Act in the Federal Court of in the Court of Federal Claims. We don't think there is Tucker Act jurisdiction. We think that the jurisdictional provision of 1681P is the provision that Congress intended, and the question is whether, in fact, there is a waiver of immunity. But even beyond, in addition to the question of the waiver of immunity, what the Supreme Court has made clear in cases like Flamingo is that even once you've got the waiver, there still has got to be a fairly searching inquiry about congressional intent. It's not as compelling as the original waiver argument, but it's something more than just the that might obtain in circumstances that did not involve the United States.
But Mr. Stern, I'm having trouble following up on Judge Rovner's question, seeing how you could take the position that Mr. Talley's claim is not a claim founded upon an act of Congress, and that language appears in both the Tucker Act itself and the Little Tucker Act. I don't see any language in the Fair Credit Reporting Act designed to repeal the Tucker Act, and cases like regional rail reorganization suggest that unless Congress has repealed, the Tucker Act stands.
Your Honor, we don't think that it's a case of implied repeal.
No, but why isn't this a case founded on an act of Congress?
Well, it's not just any, I mean, any act of Congress. When Congress confers jurisdiction.
No, but maybe you're starting the point at a different point, because the Tucker Act provides jurisdiction and a waiver of sovereign immunity for some set of cases, and one set of cases is those founded upon an act of Congress. And I would have thought the Fair Credit Reporting Act, after the 1996 amendments, imposes duties upon the government to furnish accurate information to credit reporting agencies. The government hasn't denied that, has it?
Well, I mean, there's several questions that are involved there. But one, I mean, as the Federal Circuit has recognized, when there is a specific grant of jurisdiction to a district court, that's generally been thought to confer jurisdiction just in the district court.
But your position is there is no jurisdiction in the district court for the United States. I'm not sure that's right, actually, but just staying with the Tucker Act for a minute.
Well, I think that the question that either we think that they're the right place to bring the claim is the district court. There's clearly Congress meant for these claims to go without regard to the amount of controversy to the district court. The Court of Federal Claims, which generally applies to cases that don't sound in tort, which this does. This statute has a different statute of limitations than the general statute for the United States. The Court of Federal Claims generally does not consider punitive damages, which we know would be available against the United States under the one section of the statute that clearly does apply to the United States, 1681U. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for, like, thinking that when Congress vests the jurisdiction in the district court over these actions, that's exactly what it meant to do. And certainly with respect to 1681U, that's what it did. So the question would then be, like, is there supposed to be some totally different result? And what the panel concluded, and again, Mr. Talley's never invoked the jurisdiction of the under the Tucker Act. And, you know, that may or may not be waived, but it is also clear that he didn't do to it, which we think was right, but, you know, still, you know. And what the panel concluded, which we respectfully obviously disagree with, is that you can separate out the Tucker Act waiver from the Tucker Act jurisdiction. And, there are a whole number of reasons for disagreeing with that, and that would really be in conflict with the conclusions of the Ninth and Second Circuits. But like, in the end, the question really comes down to what did Congress do?
Well, and that is an interesting question, isn't it? Because I think the government's position would require us to look at every statute, check all of the old provisions whenever it's amended, see if we can find some legislative history to say that maybe Congress wasn't thinking about the effect of a new provision on that, and kind of read out of the statute things that we think Congress wasn't thinking about, which is certainly pretty far removed from a plain language approach to statutory construction.
Your Honor, I mean, that is, after all, the approach that the Supreme Court adopted in the Fair Labor Standards Act case that we discussed. And one could say, well, you know, that was, you know, the 1970s, maybe it's different than today, but generally, in fact, the jurisprudence has moved the other way in terms of being demanding. Library of Congress versus Shaw, similarly demanding. I mean, the point...
Well, but demanding what? You're not finishing your thought.
Well, it was demanding about looking for what Congress did the second time around when it amended the statute. And
if you're going to do that, why wouldn't it be much, much more sensible simply to look at the language of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, perhaps give it a limiting construction, which the Court did recently in the Skilling case for a different statute, which the Court regularly does, and say, of course, you know, we're not going to assume that these are suits at common law and thus there's no jury. We're not going to assume that they're punitive damages, which can't be recovered against the sovereign. But a limiting construction that says the Mr. Talleys of the world can sue under the Fair Credit Reporting Act when there are willful or negligent misinformation reported.
Well, I mean, that's not a limiting construction.
Sure it is. It gets rid of punitive damages and it gets rid of juries.
Well, that's a limiting construction, the argument here is that person, when it appears, is supposed to say, in parentheses, including the United States, states, and all other governmental entities. And
but why do you have to say that in every subsection, having already... Why does Congress have to say that in every subsection, having already said it once in Section 1621A sub B?
If person means the United States and in state every time it's used, then it really means that.
But that's what a definitional clause does. It defines the word for the purpose of the rest of this statute.
Well, I'm just responding, Your Honor, to the point of could you say that it applies to the actual damages, but not the punitive damages.
Yeah, let me ask you a related question. The reason the panel discussed the Tucker Act was because the panel perceived that it was the United States' argument that even if the United States is a person for purposes of the damages clause in the Fair Credit Reporting Act, there's still a need for some separate waiver of sovereign immunity. Is that the position of the United States?
I think that the answer is yes, but I think it's also...
The reason I ask that is because I read your brief, your en banc brief, very carefully and couldn't find that position in it.
This is a damages statute. I mean, there's a real question about whether it can even be enforced.
No, look, let's just assume that you're wrong about the meaning of 1681A sub B, right? Or assume that there's a separate provision in the damages provision that says, footnote, we really mean it. Is there, in the United States' view, a need for a separate waiver of sovereign immunity?
If 1681OMP said, referred to the United States and the states,
mm-hmm.
It said that including the United States, says, no, that would be
all right. So your view then is that at least the way the Fair Credit Reporting Act is set up, two statutes are enough, one defining the wrong and the other mandating damages. There's no need for a third express waiver of sovereign immunity.
That would be what we say is, and I mean, that I think is the issue, is what Congress has done the equivalent of what Your Honor just described? If Congress had done that, really we wouldn't be here. So that's the question. And again,
of course, there's always the possibility if the panel had understood that was the government's position, we wouldn't be here.
I apologize for any misunderstanding that we've created.
So if that's wrong, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act is a waiver of sovereign immunity, don't you still argue that any appeal should have gone to the Federal Circuit?
No, we don't think that the we don't think I mean we don't think the fair, first we don't think the Fair Credit Reporting.
Yes,
Act
I know is. That. I'm asking. This. You're not following my question.
Suppose
the Fair Credit Reporting Act does contain a waiver of sovereign immunity for suits for damages against the United States, then should the appeal nevertheless have gone to the Federal Circuit? Or would the Fair Credit Reporting Act supply everything one needed?
Yes.
Okay. So your argument is that persons doesn't include the government for damages actions. That's
right.
So where does the Tucker Act come in?
We don't think that the Tucker Act comes in. I mean, that was not the basis of this lawsuit. I think.
Do you think the Tucker Act is irrelevant? We just look at the Fair Credit Reporting Act and
that's
see
right,
whether...
Your Honor. We look to see Congress provided for jurisdiction, and the question is, what did it do in 1996? And the argument the court puts, the thing advanced,
when it says that the government is a person... does that mean there can be criminal prosecutions in the United States?
Well, that's one of the, if you put person every time that it's used means the United States, state, all governmental entities, it would follow that there would be criminal prosecutions, that the United States would be subject to punitive damages, that it would be subject to state actions brought on behalf of state citizens.
Is that your main argument for why it's not a waiver of sovereign immunity?
It's one of our arguments.
Is there another argument?
Yes. I mean, our argument, what Your Honor's point goes to, in our view, is that it doesn't work to just go Congress meant what it said and said what it meant, because that really creates anomalies. We then look to a lot of other...
But is the anomaly the fact that reading person to mean the government everywhere in the statute would produce ridiculous results? Is that the...
Yes, that's the... I mean, it's the threshold... Nothing that in and of itself is necessarily conclusive, but I think it should shake us out of the assumption.
What if there was nothing about criminal or punitive or anything, and it just said it was just the only remedy was damage, it was compensatory damages, and it said that person includes government. Would there be any problem then?
We do think that there would be a problem. I mean, first,
Well, what would be the problem?
Well, first, look, the statute was enacted in 1996, a few months after Seminole Tribe.
But could I just interrupt? I mean, you're worrying about the states, but in some ways I think you're getting ahead of yourself because, for one thing, if there were a constitutional problem with a particular application of the statute, then the statute wouldn't be applied for that. That's what happened to the Violence Against Women Act. That's what happened to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which continued to apply in some matters, and it didn't apply in other ways. And so if there happened to be, following the Seminole Tribe line, a reason not to sue the states because of all the concerns about the 11th Amendment, then so be it. But Congress is not operating under the same constitutional limitations when it's legislating about duties imposed on the federal government.
No,
so it seems to me, our case is about whether the Department of Agriculture had any duties to begin with under the Fair Credit Reporting Act to pass along accurate information. And secondly, is there a remedy? And it sounds to me like you're putting all of your eggs in the basket that the only place there could be a remedy is the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and there isn't one there. So the Department of Agriculture and the rest of the United States, in fact, really has no enforceable duties under this statute.
Well, can I go back to the Seminole Tribe point? Because it is not, Your Honor is, of course, right that the court could invalidate an application to the states.
And it happens all the time. You would also agree.
Violence Against Women Act was my case.
Oh, all right. So
I have lots of cases that way. But
sorry, didn't mean to touch a nerve.
But the issue here is whether we're looking to see what Congress intended, and there really are presumptions that Congress didn't intend to enact a unconstitutional statute, and to enact this with regard to the states months after Seminole Tribe.
I think you're missing a point. There's no similar problem if the statute is read simply as waiving the sovereign immunity of the United States. And my simple question was, if all the statute said was that person includes the United States, and the only remedy were damages, compensatory damages, would that be the end of the analysis, or do you think that somehow the statute would still be unclear or has to use a different form of words to waive sovereign immunity?
I just want to make sure I understand the premise, which is that person was defined to mean.
I just said that, for goodness sake.
I'm sorry, I don't repeat what I said.
Just listen.
Obviously, as statute gets changed, there become fewer and fewer problems.
Well, are there any problems with the statute as I've described it? Says person is the United States, and the only remedy in the statute is compensatory damages.
At that point, the only problems at that point start to become ones that start to become, A, there's no indication, and I agree, but maybe the legislative history carries no weight, but there is no indication that Congress meant to impose all of these new liabilities.
But are you saying that even if a statute is clear, there has to be legislative history? Because in my example, statute is perfectly clear, even though it doesn't use the word waiver, waiver of sovereign immunity. Why would you have to look at legislative? Maybe you look at legislative history if it contradicted it, but why would you look at it if it didn't say anything?
Because I'm assuming that Breyer meant that the 1970 definition said United States, said person means United States. I do think it would be, in that case, at least it would raise questions, and particularly in light of the fact that there are other federal statutes in this area that really do have to be reconciled.
But some of them run your way, and others that your opponents have pointed out run in the other direction. And I guess I'm uncomfortable with some presumption that you're implicitly arguing for, that Congress hasn't read the earlier statute when it amends. I mean, your view is very much tied to the idea that Congress was oblivious when it amended the 1996 statute, and putting to one side whatever anybody may think about the legislative process, that's just not the way courts can operate.
Well, again, I mean, there are Supreme Court decisions which look to legislative history in the context of an amendment, and this is not, I mean, this really, you know, often when, I mean, I was looking through to see, like, you know, the, you know, when this kind of legislation goes through, there's statements about what is the financial impact, you know, on the United States and the states. You know, you go through here, it was, you know, minor impact. Nobody expects anything. There is not, you know, this is, I mean, a person really meant, like, what the plaintiff says that it meant, and it just encompassed the old definition. One would expect some recognition somewhere that this was going to impose a lot of liabilities.
What, why? Are you assuming that the United States violates the Fair Credit Reporting Act a lot?
No.
Then it wouldn't impose a lot of liability. It imposes liability only on people who violate the statute.
Your Honor, it's still that the amount of money that can be sought for relatively technical violations of this statute, which has a, for this statute to collect money for negligence, there just, whereas the Privacy Act, which covers, there's huge overlap.
Well, since this statute was amended to provide for damages, how many suits under the Fair Credit Reporting Act have been filed against the United States?
I don't know. This could be the first.
Well, so it doesn't sound like a lot of liability.
I don't think that a lot of people thought that this statute applied to the United States.
But Are you saying, basically, you're conceding that you had a substantive duty to report accurately? You are conceding that.
I mean, the privacy.
No. That's sort of a yes or no.
Well, it is yes, and I
right.
also.
Right. But no liability of the breach of that duty. I mean, is that it? Is that. No, really. Is that your position?
Yes. There is no liability under this statute.
Under any statute,
well,
you're
the
saying?
The Privacy Act also specifically deals with the obligations of the United States in making reports specifically to consumer reporting agencies. I mean, referencing the definition, you know, of this statute. And it says, this is what you do, you know, to avoid Privacy Act liability. You establish procedures to do this. And there are
And have there been Privacy Act cases brought, if that's the obvious remedy?
I don't know whether there have enough, but that would be if to the extent that there are either Privacy Act remedies for injunctive relief or for damages for that, then, I mean, the Privacy Act really is designed. It's a very calibrated system of relief, and it's been around since 1974. And it was, in fact, partly modeled on the Fair Credit Act of 1970, but it has lots of overlap with the obligations that then got imposed more broadly on sort of, persons later on. I mean, and this has, I mean, it specifically deals with the kind of situation that's presented here, where we're trying to get the United States to correct information. I mean, this is all stuff that Congress has looked at for a long time and was concerned about. I mean, so it's not.
So are those cases brought in the Court of Federal Claims?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Privacy Act cases go to Court of Federal Claims?
No, they don't. They go to the District Court.
Mr. Stern, you've pointed out it. The rather unusual provision in 1681U, which authorizes punitive damages explicitly against the federal government, where taxpayers wind up being held responsible in punitive damages for misconduct by government officials. How unusual is that provision?
It's very unusual. I mean, as the Supreme Court said in the False Claims Act case, was to put aside. I mean, it's generally very unusual for punitive damages, but again, 1681U it's clear why they did that, because Congress was also authorizing the FBI to specifically get the kind of information for counterintelligence purposes. And it says, and if there's any misuse, you know, basically of the privilege that we've given you, there will be available punitive damages. And interestingly, unlike the rest of the statute, it also provides for injunctive and administrative remedies.
Are there comparable examples in other fields of federal law?
Of punitive damages?
Explicitly authorized against the United States government.
I'm almost sure that there are, but there are not very many. I can certainly find out what they are and let the court know. But it is by far the exception. And again, it here is very much tied to a very particular right that was being given to the FBI, and Congress being extremely concerned that getting that sensitive information not be misused. And it has the kind of, and that's the kind of focus scheme that you would sort of expect to have for the United States, and the way that lots of other schemes that are all directed to different aspects of what goes on here, like the Debt Collection Act, the Privacy Act. I mean, you know, this is a heavily regulated universe for the federal government. You know, and I don't think it's that Congress was oblivious. I think that it didn't think that it was doing what the district court held that it did. But I don't think that it thought that it was giving the United States a free pass in the world of information disclosure.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. Mr. Radbill.
Damages may be awarded against the United States if Congress does three things. One, create a right or duty. Two, mandate compensation for violation of that right or duty. And three, expressly authorize relief.
We've spent all this time talking about the Fair Credit Reporting Act, but you place very little emphasis on it. Your discussion in your rehearing brief is just a page. You don't seem to have your heart in it.
I'm sorry?
You don't seem to have your heart in it.
Into the Fair Credit Reporting Act?
Yes.
I think that it doesn't seem so. It was a mistake. The Fair Credit Reporting Act against the backdrop of the Tucker Act. If it's
no, I'm trying to separate.
Sure.
Separate.
The Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Because you do say, it's just that you say it and so briefly and kind of apologetically, that the Fair Credit Reporting Act can stand on its own feet without the Tucker Act.
Sure.
But you don't say anything about it.
The Fair Credit Reporting Act can stand at its own feet.
Well, what puzzles me about it is that if you read it literally to mean that wherever the word person appears, you can substitute the United States, you end up with goofy results. Criminal prosecutions against the United States? I can understand criminal prosecutions against federal officials. Against the United States? That would be kind of extraordinary. What put the United States on probation, supervised release of the United States.
I think it may, in fact,
I mean, this would be. We'd love that.
So, Mr. Radbill, awkward is hardly the word for it, and I'm interested in your response to this too. But let me ask you first whether either the Fair Credit Reporting Act or perhaps the Consumer Credit Protection Act as a whole has any severability provisions.
Any severability provisions with respect to the punitive damages clause?
With respect to anything. A lot of statutes say if any provision or any part of this is invalid, everything else is severable and remains in effect.
I think the answer to your question, if I'm not mistaken, lies in a brief written by the United States and submitted to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the case United States Department of Agriculture, Moore versus Department of Agriculture. And it speaks to Your Honor's question as to criminal liability. And the position the government took was that the anomaly is more esoteric than it is practical. In fact, if the Attorney General of the United States does not wish to impose criminal penalties against the United States, well, in fact, they won't do so if, in fact, the odd set of...
Well, that's true of all criminal statutes. There's always discretion.
So
the government says that the Fifth Circuit...
that Moore is distinguishable because the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, unlike the Fair Credit Reporting Act, specifically recognizes the difference between government creditors and non-governmental creditors, and exempts the former, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, from punitive damages. I mean, isn't that a significant difference?
Yes, it is, and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act does exempt the United States from punitive damages. However, it uses an identical definitional section and an identical statutory scheme, and the court, the Fifth Circuit, found an express waiver of the United States sovereign immunity. And going along that line of reasoning, we then need to look to another familial statute, the Truth in Lending Act, which is under the same chapter of the United States Code as the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And what that statute does, using the same language, the same definitional provisions, the same statutory and remedial scheme, expressly reserves a reservation of sovereign immunity. So it says, we knew as Congress that in the Truth in Lending Act, we were subjecting the United States to damages.
So you're suggesting that that making the United States criminally liable is actually that is the statute. That's what Congress intended, you're saying. Congress intended to make the United States criminally liable for violation of the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
I'm saying that if in fact...
That's what you're saying. Congress intended that because it knows how to make explicit exemptions.
Right? Yes.
That's your proposition.
Or maybe, I mean, another way of putting it is we have to assume that when Congress left the definition of person alone in 1996... the consequence at the moment for the Fair Credit Reporting Act is that Congress has created a fairly goofy statute. Congress could, of course, go back and fix it if it wanted to. There's nothing constitutional about this. There's nothing beyond touching. But it, if you will, went further than maybe it should have.
Goofy? Maybe. Completely wrong? I don't think so. And we look to the punitive damages argument, and to address Your Honor's question to counsel for the government, there are cases in which the United States is subject to punitive damages. In fact, the IRS has been held liable for punitive damages. The Fourth Circuit noted that in that States for a violation of 26 U.S.C. 7431, which requires disclosure of certain tax information. We look to the Southern District of Texas Bankruptcy Court in In Re Lisle.
Are these under statutes that explicitly authorize punitive damages against the United States?
Explicitly authorize, Your Honor, I don't know if I can answer that question.
It might be important.
Yes, it is important. I can tell you that the Fourth Circuit upheld the award of punitive damages against the IRS. The Southern District of Bankruptcy Court awarded $100,000 against the U.S. with respect to the IRS punitive damages. The District Court of Maryland in Roy versus Runyon held the United States Postal Service liable for punitive damages for violation.
But no one doubts that Congress can make the government liable for punitive damages. The question is whether you require some greater explicitness than in this statute. Especially since, as you say, you know, if person means the United States in every provision, leads to really preposterous results.
If, in fact, we read it in a certain manner, it would lead to an absurd result. But that is why we...
Is there some way to read it as excluding criminal prosecutions against the United States?
To read the actual statute as to exclude it? Possibly.
Possibly how?
I think the best argument is with respect to the United States position that was submitted. In fact, noting that the anomaly that Your Honor talks about is esoteric. It's not practical. It's not going to happen, and therefore...
But is it the law?
Yes, it is the law.
It is the law. The United States can be prosecuted criminally under the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Yes.
Well, unless the panel is correct. Because, of course, if what the panel held, which is that the claim arises under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the duty is there and the right to sue, but that the Tucker Act actually implicitly contains both a jurisdictional conferral and a waiver of sovereign immunity. Once you're into the Tucker Act's waiver of sovereign immunity, there are no punitive damages, there's no criminal liability, it's a limited waiver, but you don't seem to be defending the panel's understanding of the Tucker Act.
I am, and I agree with you. And my my question was...
So does that mean that any federal statute can be the subject of a damages suit?
Any federal statute that creates a right or duty that mandates compensation for violation of that
right. No, it doesn't have to include any reference to compensation, does it?
Yes, it does.
Fairly interpreted to mandate compensation.
But it doesn't have to require the United States to pay compensation. Any federal statute that creates a damages remedy, even if it doesn't mention any government, that could be turned against the United States in a Tucker Act.
No, I thought you were arguing that that the fact that the Fair Credit Reporting Act imposes liability on government and government agencies was of some importance here. I'm not sure how whether you were going as broadly as Judge Post.
I'm sorry. I guess just to understand. We need to look at this in two contexts, one with the Tucker Act and one without the Tucker Act, which was Your Honor's original question. With the Tucker Act, we need a right, we need a mandate for compensation, and in the Tucker Act, you get the express authorization for suit against...
So what you're saying is, I think this is what you're saying, is that any federal statute that creates a damages remedy can be used against the United States in a Tucker Act suit.
If the substantive duty can be fairly interpreted to exist with respect to the United States, if the mandatory compensation for violation of that duty can be fairly interpreted to...
But what if you have a statute which says that nobody shall dye his hair pink, but that in the case of a private violation of the statute, there is a damages remedy. In the case of the government, it's just an injunctive remedy. So could that case be brought under the Tucker Act against the United States for damages? It's creating liability in the government. It's creating a damages remedy, but it doesn't say that the damages remedy is against the States.
Well, that is what the Tucker Act does in part if we look to the fair interpretation standard.
But that means that without amending the Tucker Act, the government would have to state in every statute that creates a damages remedy and includes some government liability that can have damages against the government.
Your argument is very hard to reconcile with Testan. And Testan says there need to be three separate decisions. One creates the substantive right. The second mandates damages. And the third waives sovereign immunity. And Testan says the Tucker Act does only the third. It doesn't do the second. You're now reading the Tucker Act as doing the second. Is there any support in the Supreme Court's cases for that?
No. I wasn't clear. With respect to this case, the substantive rights created at 1681S2 in conjunction with section 1681A sub B. That's the substantive duty imposed upon the United States. The money
and it's important in that conjunction, I take it, to your argument, that the words government or government agency are in there. There wouldn't be a substantive duty on the United States if that hadn't explicitly been said.
Correct.
I have one more Tucker Act question. I just want to be absolutely sure about your answer. Are you relying on the jurisdiction provided by the Tucker Act, either big or little?
Yes. The jurisdiction of the Tucker Act?
Yes, the jurisdiction of the Tucker Act.
No. Jurisdiction of the Tucker Act? No. The waiver of sovereign immunity in the Tucker Act, yes.
I suppose it's beyond, you don't have to answer this question, but why? If you answer that question yes, what's going to happen immediately is a transfer of this appeal to the Federal Circuit. But, of course, then you might actually be able to win under the Tucker Act. If you answer no, you are pretty much giving things away.
Well, the waiver of sovereign immunity and the jurisdiction are not coextensive, as this Court noted in its decision, the panel decision.
But we are, of course, here reviewing the panel's decision. So
the panel's decision was vacated. It counts for zilch.
Correct.
So how do the same words that actually seem to speak of jurisdiction until Mitchell 2 came along from the Supreme Court how do you dissect out a jurisdictional half and a waiver of sovereign immunity half?
Jurisdiction with respect to Mr. Talley's claim lies in the district court, and it lies with respect to...
Why isn't it concurrent, at least? I think Chief Judge Easterbrook is right that it seems you have little to lose and perhaps something to gain if you thought it were concurrent.
If the Tucker Act jurisdiction were concurrent with the...
Right. You know, a choice of forum is hardly unknown in federal law. Sometimes you can take an appeal to a couple of different circuits. Sometimes you can file in a couple of different courts. So it's a mystery to me why you're so adamant that there's no interest in relying on Tucker Act jurisdiction.
Because Mr. Talley need not rely upon the Tucker Act jurisdiction. He just doesn't have to do so in this particular case.
But you see, what's strange about your argument, as long as you're in the Fair Credit Reporting Act and you argue that it grants an explicit right of seek damages against the United States, that's fine. You bring district courts. But once you abandon the Fair Credit Reporting Act to the extent of saying, no, they didn't actually grant a damages right against the United States in that act. So now you have the act that imposes a duty on the United States. It grants damages remedies for private persons, but not against the United States. And now you go to the Tucker Act in order to pick up the government's liability for damages. But if you go to the Tucker Act, isn't it clear that you have to be in the Tucker Act jurisdictional, you know, in the right court for the Tucker Act? Because that's what the Tucker Act says. It grants jurisdiction to, you know, bring certain suits in the Court of Claims or in the courts.
Tucker Act grants jurisdiction in the Court of Claims, but not exclusive jurisdiction. In fact, the Supreme Court in Bowen versus Massachusetts noted the Court
of Claims... Well, it's exclusive if it's more than 10,000, right?
I respectfully disagree. No. It is not exclusive. It is exclusive only to the extent that Congress has not, in another statutory provision, provided for jurisdiction elsewhere. So there is a situation, take, for example, a contract claim. If a contract claim amounted to more than $10,000, it is theoretically possible that absolute jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction, lies in the Court of Federal Claims. And that's theoretically possible because there's no additional statute providing for jurisdiction elsewhere, but we don't have that here. We have Section 1681P of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which provides an additional jurisdictional provision to the district courts without regard to the amount of controversy or any court of competent jurisdiction. So, while a contract claim, such as the Ninth Circuit and Second Circuit cases discussed by the United States in their brief, may in fact...
But you've always got 1331, right? I mean, you've always got... If you have a federal claim, there's always jurisdiction in federal... You're suggesting that as long as you have a statute that imposes liability on the United States, you can bring a damages suit anywhere by just, you know, appealing to the Act of Congress, the term Act of Congress in the Tucker Act.
I think that...
That's your position.
Prospective plaintiff could bring a suit anywhere that Congress authorizes jurisdiction for that suit, and if that be in a district court with respect to 1681P in the Tucker Act...
I don't know why you worried 1331, right? Federal question jurisdiction. We have a statute which imposes a duty on the United States, and you go to the term Act of Congress in the Tucker Act, and you say, well, this means you can bring a damages suit against the United States. That's a waiver of liability, waiver of sovereign immunity for all claims under a federal statute that's applicable to the government.
I think we are positive.
Is that not your position? Is that overbroad?
I believe so, but I'm not certain that I understand. If we look at... There are two ways that this Federal Credit Reporting Act could be enforced against the United States. One with the Tucker Act, one without the Tucker Act. With the Tucker Act, we get a lesser standard of construction. We need only look to Section 1681S2 and AB and 1681N and O, which is the liability section. And
well, what if the Fair Credit Reporting Act just said that no government or individual shall make misrepresentations, but it didn't say anything about remedies?
we need a money mandating provision. We need a provision which does that. And that's
why? But because you use, I don't understand why.
Because a duty in and of itself doesn't create liability against the United States. It comes from these Tucker Act cases, White versus U.S., where there was Indian tribes that had land, and there was a fiduciary responsibility.
But we're proceeding now on the assumption that the Fair Credit Reporting Act does not impose damages liability on the United States. And that's why we've gone to the Tucker Act waiver of sovereign immunity. So that's saying, I think, any federal statute that imposes a duty on the federal government, whether or not it creates a damages remedy against the federal government, nevertheless, that can be sued upon in any federal court seeking damages on the basis of the Tucker Act. I think that's your position.
If we use the Tucker Act, then we have a duty and a right, we have a money mandating provision, we have an express right to relief under the Tucker Act, and the provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act need only be fairly interpreted to meet that test. But we're not abandoning if, in fact, the court wishes to look to the FCRA in and of itself, and then we need to meet the clear intent test. So it is possible to bring a suit under the FCRA in and of itself and or the Tucker Act. With the Tucker Act, we don't have to meet that clear intent standard. We go back to the duty and right creating provisions and the money mandating provision, and they need to be fairly interpreted.
Why is the money mandate provision in the FRCA important to you? Because suppose what the Fair Credit Reporting Act said was that the government is, government is liable. Government has to obey the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And private companies are subject to. Wouldn't you still be arguing that at that point you can take the Tucker Act waiver of sovereign immunity to allow a suit?
If, in fact, we have a statute such as the FCRA, then yes, because we have a provision that has a duty imposed upon the United States and a money mandating provision saying, look, if that is violated, then compensation in amount.
No, you're missing my point. Suppose we interpret the federal, let me put this way. Suppose we interpret the federal, the reporting, suppose we interpret that to mean that the word person does not include the United States in the provision relating to damages or punitive damages. Suppose, is that the end of your case? Is that interpretation the end of your case? Or can you then, even though we've held there's no damages remedy created against the United States by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, nevertheless, you can jump into the Tucker Act?
Sure.
That's your essential point. So there's no reason to have monetary liability imposed on the United States by the Fair Credit Reporting Act. All you need is the obligation of the government to comply with the Act, and then you get the damages from the Tucker Act. Isn't that your position?
I don't think so.
No, I think it's got to be, because if you lose on the Fair Credit Reporting Act, if we hold that persons does not include the United States in the damages provisions, at that point you jump into the Tucker Act, surely.
Yes.
Okay. That means that you don't need a statute that grants a damages remedy against the United States to bring the kind of suit you brought, because you can use the Tucker Act to create that damages liability.
To a degree, yes, it lessens the standard. We need not meet that clear, express intent.
You don't need any intent. You don't need anything. You don't need anything in the Fair Credit Reporting Act about damages against the United States. You don't need that person equals the United States for damages purposes.
As long as the Tucker Act can connect, as long as the Fair Credit Reporting Act can be fairly construed to mandate compensation for a violation of duties imposed thereon.
No, but what if it says the government shall be liable for injunctive relief under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and there's no mention of damages? Isn't that the point at which you jump into the Tucker Act to get your damages?
Tucker Act revolves around a request for money damages, and you know, with respect.
So you think that the underlying statute has to allow for money damages before you can plug into the Tucker Act and get money damages? So a statute that says only injunctive relief against the government wouldn't be amenable to enforcement through a damages action using the Tucker Act?
I think that the underlying statute needs to be able to be fairly construed to mandate money damages.
But suppose we hold that our construction of the Fair Credit Reporting Act is it doesn't allow damages against the government. Is that the end of your case, or do you jump into the Tucker Act?
It is not the end of the case. We go into the Tucker Act if, in fact, that's...
But that means that what the Fair Credit Reporting Act says about damages is irrelevant. It's completely irrelevant. All that's important is that it creates the duty, it imposes the duty of compliance on the government. It doesn't have to authorize damages for anybody. It just has to have duty on the government. Doesn't have to say anything about damages for anybody. It could just say this statute is enforceable by equitable remedies, period. Say that. And don't you have to argue that at that point you jump into the Tucker Act to get your waiver of sovereign immunity from a damages suit?
We jump to the Tucker Act to get the express authorization for relief against the United
States. But at that point, I don't understand, but I've asked this question before, I don't understand how your position can be reconciled with Testan, which says there has to be a money-mandating statute requiring compensation by the United States, and that the Tucker Act is not itself such a statute. Right?
Right.
It seems to me you have to say, unless you want us to contradict Testan, that unless the Fair Credit Reporting Act can be understood as a money-mandating statute requiring the United States to pay money, you lose.
Yes, yes.
But you answered Judge Posner 180 degrees the opposite.
I apologize. I did not mean to. And my reference to the fair interpretation was, in effect, an attempt to answer.
But that means you've now tied the Fair Credit Reporting Act to the Tucker Act. We have to find that the Fair Credit Reporting Act creates a money remedy against the United States. Right?
And at that point, it becomes a question of forum. And I wanted to raise this issue anyway. It's unclear to me why that interpretation is something you resist so much. The reason one could think that the Tucker Act exists is because the United States likes to be sued, if it's going to be sued at all, in the Court of Federal Claims, and it particularly likes appeals to go to the Federal Circuit, which is, after all, only one forum, so you don't have to worry about conflicts in the circuit and the like. There are interests that are valid interests that the United States may have in a jurisdictional allocation like that. And it doesn't mean that statutes aren't enforceable. It means that people who want to enforce against the government have to suffer the inconvenience of going to the District of Columbia.
Jurisdiction with regard to Mr. Talley's claim is based upon the Tucker Act. But in this case, jurisdiction is based upon 1331.
Well, we understand that's your point. And the 1331 point, I think some of the issues that Judge Posner was raising have existed ever since 1980, when the jurisdictional amount of controversy was deleted from 1331. We're left with the question, why do we bother to have any other jurisdictional statutes? And I'm not sure that you can answer that right now, but that's what it is.
With respect to jurisdiction, and please stop me if speaking in it doesn't need to be said, but the district court has subject matter jurisdiction under 1331 and 1681P, and that jurisdiction was not based upon the Tucker Act. And if, in fact, it was in whole or part, yes, we go to the Federal Circuit. But if it's not, we stay in the district court.
Now, so would you like us to transfer to the Federal Circuit if we wind up disagreeing with you on enough things that's on the table?
if all else fails, I would. The only way to go, of course.
Okay, I just wanted that to be clear.
Reach that situation. I think that the court had jurisdiction. I think that if you look at the policy underlying the Big and Little Tucker Act, it fits very well. Piece of the puzzle seems.
No, look, Judge Wood's question didn't have anything to do with the difference between the Big and Little Tucker Act. Since you recovered only $10,000, you're entitled to do that in the district court. The question was, where does the appeal go?
The appeal goes, if in fact jurisdiction is based upon the Tucker Act in whole or part, to the Federal Circuit. If jurisdiction is based upon 1331 and 1681P, the appeal stays right here.
But to the extent that you're invoking the sovereign immunity waiver of the Tucker Act, why aren't you bound by its limitations?
Because they are not one and the same. Because sovereign immunity...
It's the same clause in the statute.
Sure, but sovereign immunity does not take away from a federal court subject matter jurisdiction. They are two different situations. In fact...
It's a jurisdictional limitation on the waiver of sovereign immunity.
I don't...
It's a forum-specific waiver of sovereign immunity, in other words.
I don't think that it is. I respectfully don't think that it is. I think that the Ninth Circuit said that it was, and they misinterpreted the Supreme Court's analysis in Bowen. I think the Second Circuit said they did and based it upon the fact that jurisdiction and sovereign immunity are one and the same, but jurisdiction and sovereign immunity aren't one and the same. Sovereign immunity, a claim for sovereign immunity goes to
the argument, right, the argument isn't that they're one and the same. The argument is a package deal. But if you want the Tucker Act's waiver of sovereign immunity, you take the Tucker Act's jurisdiction.
I think that if we make it a package deal, we then conflate sovereign immunity with subject matter jurisdiction, and I don't think that that is appropriate, and I don't think that that is how this court has addressed it.
Are you saying that all the Tucker Act has ever done was create an alternative forum?
No. This
you get your choice. You're a district court under the waiver of immunity part of it, and then you go to a regional court of appeals, or if you want, you go to the... I don't understand.
Tucker Act creates a waiver of sovereign immunity and a grant of jurisdiction, which are...
I know, but if you can detach the waiver of immunity, the effect of the Tucker Act is simply to create an alternative form for everybody. Can you think of any case where you only go under the Tucker Act? Because there'll always be an act of Congress or a regulation that authorizes the suit, and then you jump into and you invoke 1331.
With respect to a statute, no, you can't get to the Tucker Act alone. A contract.
Why? I don't get you. Well, why could, under your view, why can't you always proceed under 1331 by just attaching the waiver of immunity in the Tucker Act to your statute creating a right?
Always proceed where?
In the district court, but under 1331, as you've done here.
Because there is a jurisdictional provision allowing for us...
Yeah, 1331.
1681.
Well, you don't need that, as Judge Woods said. You have 1331. So what you're saying is, it's not just a fair credit reporting. There's no claim against the United States for damages which couldn't be litigated, on your view, under 1331. Because if you need a waiver of sovereign immunity, you have it right, you have it here.
If you need a waiver of sovereign immunity, I'm sorry, I don't understand, Your Honor.
Forget it. I may not understand it myself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Radbill.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Stern?
The court's been very generous with its time, and just...
I had one question for you. 1681S2 is the provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act that imposes the substantive obligations, right? It essentially says you have to submit accurate information. And it uses the word person. So is it your view that the United States is not a person for 1681S2? Or is it a person for 1681S2, but not for O and, you know, all these other ones we've been talking about, N and O?
Your Honor, I do think that that clearly the United States is a person for various purposes.
So in other words, you're willing to say it is a person for some parts of the statute and it's not a person for other parts of the statute. No, really, is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if that's true, then why do we draw the line where you want to draw it? If you're going to admit that it is a person for S2, then why isn't it a person for the provision about suing?
Yes, it has to be a person for certain parts of the statute. No, but I mean,
okay.
When you go back, there a lot of the references, in fact, most.
But I think that makes your whole argument fall apart, to tell you the truth. But
I hate to have that happen. I mean, one of the reason the person included governments to begin with, even when person had no bearing whatsoever on monetary liability, is that the transactions that are described in the statute frequently talk about persons.
I understand, but S2 is one of the parts that was added in 1996.
Is. Also,
and you're agreeing that the old 1990 definition of person does apply to this one new
there
part.
I would have to say that the overlap with the Privacy Act would have to, because that is a question I fully agree, but there the overlap with the Privacy Act would, I think, require determination about whether and to what extent S2 replaces the Privacy Act provisions that specifically deal with disclosures to credit reporting agencies, the procedures that are created to make corrections.
Just to follow up on Judge Wisman, do you concede that the Fair Credit Reporting Act imposes some enforceable duties on the government? Enforceable not by damages, of course, that's your position, but enforceable by injunctive. Not criminal, not damages, but how about injunctive?
I mean, the answer to that, Your Honor, is that is no, but that's based on the fact that that the Fair Credit Reporting Act does not seem to be a statute that contemplates any injunctive relief. It is a statute written as a damage.
But then you're saying the government really isn't liable for violating the statute.
How could there be liability under the Privacy Act unless the United States is a person for the purposes of 1681S?
No, I mean, the Privacy Act imposes its own liability. It covers a lot of the same ground. And there are other statutes that do, too. And to say that the United States isn't liable in a lawsuit isn't at all the same thing as saying that it's not constrained to comply with...
Now I'm getting lost. Does your answer to Judge Posner's question retract your answer to Judge Wood's question, or do you view the two as consistent?
That I view them as consistent, but I'm just trying to...
But whether we view them as consistent is a more difficult question.
The answer is that, no, don't think that there are enforceable obligations in the sense of being judicially enforceable. This is a damages statute.
But you're then standing on your answer to Judge Wood's question, which is the United States is a person for purposes of what the duties are. You just think that the judicial branch can't do anything about enforcing those duties.
Yes, but in addition to that, I think that with respect to various duties, that's not sort of an all, that assuming that they are, it wouldn't be an all or nothing proposition, because there are a lot of other federal statutes that very specifically deal with duties in a way that's particular to the federal government.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.